Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. Thank you for joining us today. Before I introduce my guest, I want to share what's happening here at Responsive Fundraising. In January, we will be introducing not one, not two, not three. We will be introducing four new members of Responsive's consulting practice. Whereas I will continue to serve a select few clients, my time will become more focused on strengthening the brand, identifying new opportunities, and developing the Responsive theory. These individuals will take the lead with Responsive's growing national network of clients. As you will soon discover, we believe these four individuals have exactly what it takes to take our practice to a whole new level. Each of these individuals believes in the vision of Responsive Fundraising. They have a desire to redefine what it means to partner with charitable organizations, and they want to be a part of creating organizations where fundraising can thrive. We're not quite ready to let the cat out of the bag as to who these four individuals are. However, I can assure you that no one is more eager and excited than me to introduce you to all of our new team members. Hi, Angie. Thank you for being on the podcast with me this morning. Before we get started, would you mind just introducing yourself to our listeners?
Oh, hi, Jason. It's a pleasure to be back speaking with you again. I live in Brantford, Ontario, about an hour outside of Toronto, home of Wayne Gretzky. And I'm the director of philanthropy at a children's treatment center in Brantford. So we have a lot of programs that are fully funded, but there unfortunately are some that are not. And my role here is to secure enough donor dollars to make sure our programs still run.
Yes, Angie. So you and I met in Toronto back in February, and I recall before you signed up for the seminar, you reached out to me and you said, is this really right for me, or something of the sort, right? Am I recalling how that played out correctly?
It absolutely is. So I joined the AFP, which most people, maybe if you're a fundraiser, you'll know what that is, Association of Fundraising Professionals. And I have made it, I really work hard in keeping up to date with what's new in our profession. So I attend Congress and I go to webinars, right, and I go to seminars. And when I read the name of the seminar, I wasn't too sure whether or not it was something, was it too junior or where that level, you know, would appeal to me. And then you and I started chatting on LinkedIn, and I realized it was something that I definitely wanted to attend for sure.
Yeah, I still don't know. So
I think it was like, how does fundraising work? And I thought to myself, oh my goodness, I've been in this business not a long time, but long enough that I feel, oh dear, I can tell you how fundraising works.
Yeah, I can tell you how it works.
You know, and if 5-minute elevator speech, I can tell you how it works. So I didn't know. We're not a charity that has a lot of money in terms of I can't spend thousands and thousands of dollars going to seminars. So a lot of them I actually pay for myself because I'm not dedicated to my profession, and I didn't want to kind of waste my money. So in a nutshell, so that's kind of why I reached out to you.
When I first started presenting that content in that particular format with the four sessions and the cards and all that sort of stuff, I referred to it as the contrarian's guide. And I was generally referring to myself, you know, that I was contrarian and people had described me that way and so forth. But then there was a woman who showed up. She actually came from upstate Michigan and flew all the way to my seminar in Washington, D.C. And she said that the contrarian's guide was, I don't know, she convinced me that it was too combative, or it was too I don't know, edgy or something. And so she and I went back and forth. It was over a summer break sort of time period. We went back and forth for a couple of weeks. And anyway, we came up with how fundraising really works. I still don't know if that necessarily sufficiently encapsulates exactly what I'm trying to accomplish there.
Or you could maybe change it to, so you think you know how fundraising really works. What you taught was definitely gave me a lot to take back with me home to Brantford and present in my board meeting.
So let's talk about that. So you, before we hit the record button, you were sharing with me that you took one of a couple of those cards. And you shared what sounds like you had a conversation about the two cultures card. So why don't you sort of unpack that for me, and, I'll be interested to hear, and I'm sure our listeners will appreciate that as well.
So I've been in my role almost 3 years, and when I got here, being a smaller foundation, typical of many foundations, they do a lot of events. It's like a quick way to make money. That's the way I kind of look at it. Events are great. They build friends. They build your brand, get your name out there, and they're fun. But they're very labor intensive. And sometimes the events that you run will not sustain donors. The donors will do a pledge. They may participate, but they don't really understand you or your brand and they don't necessarily want to go through your funnel. They don't want to turn into a monthly donor or an annual donor or maybe even a planned gift. So this has been something that I've been battling with and can't be a one-woman show. I just can't. So I really wanted to get a secondary person in this office, divide and conquer. You know, you can do the events. I'm going to do more one-on-one presentations to major gifts, individual donors, larger philanthropists. So when I got the one card, which was showed you three lanes, the outermost lane, if you can imagine you're running a track, the outermost lane was very much fundraising. And the inner lane is more of that one-on-one engagement with a donor. And you could see that accomplishing your goal would happen a lot faster in that inner lane versus the outer lane, which is where a lot of the events are, and it's arm's length fundraising. You're not really engaging fast enough maybe with your donor. You maybe are going to achieve that dollar figure that you need by your year end, but accomplishing maybe if you were looking at takes a lot longer to raise $20,000 in an event than it would be to sit down with a formidable donor and have a great conversation and say, is this something that you think you can be part of? And that's what really hit me. And I took those cards and I presented it to our board. And I said, this is where we are. We are in the outer lane. We're always taking the longest. It's taking us so long to get around that track. We're not necessarily securing the donors that we want. We need someone to stay on that track, but somebody else to be running inside and accomplishing two goals. And that really made sense to them.
Yeah. So I always appreciate listening to sort of debriefing, if you will. And I realize it's been almost 9 months since you and I met and we went over those cards, but it's kind of fascinating to hear you use essentially an analogy that has never occurred to me, but it's the running a track analogy in that outermost lane.
That's my phys ed background.
So you ran, you said you ran track in high school or something, or?
High school.
Yeah. And so.
And I was the short, I liked the short 100. It's my A type personality. Uh-huh. I liked the short 100, 200 sprints, hurdles. The people that liked to do the long cross country take forever was never my cup of tea. And it's still not that way. I don't love running long distance. So I just, when I saw that, I looked at it like a track. I looked at it like, oh, who wants to be on the outside? You can get so much done faster on the inside.
So what so help me out here, because I really want to appreciate the sort of the analogy of a runner. So what changes sort of psychologically for somebody who chooses to run from the outer lane to the inner lane? There has to be a and it's also got to be it's like you're talking about yourself being a short distance runner versus a long distance runner. There has to be a mm-hmm. There has to be sort of a mental mm-hmm. Change mm-hmm. in the way you're thinking. Am I right?
Yeah, I think a long distance runner, if you run long distances, they tell you psychologically, they always tell, if I'm right, don't go out too hard, too fast. You have to maintain a certain pace. You have those hand, you know, your Apple Watch. It's telling you what you're running per minute, and you want to keep a certain pace. The long distance runner knows they're going to get there. It's just going to take a while. It's a short distance. You go out and you go fast and you go hard and you will reach your finish line very quickly. So it's a mentality is like, unfortunately, with the world I live in, I have a target. And I have to accomplish that target every single year. So yeah. my year is March 31st. So do I have the luxury of just laying back and taking my time? No, there's things that even with an event though, I mean, they take some events take a year to plan.
Yeah.
And what you actually reach in terms of your target hopefully is quite good. So you could spend a whole year planning that event. Whereas, and you may make, let's say you make 100,000 in that event, which in a community of 100,000 people like mine is can be very tough
pretty
to
good.
Do.
Yeah.
But if you spend that whole year and you run this like a sales program, and on Monday you make, I used to be in sales, so on Monday I would have to make 100 calls. Mm-hmm. A day, every Monday, 100 calls. And I would make sure I had 5 appointments booked every day for the next 4 days. And you fill your funnel. Because, I'm sorry, fundraising in very many ways is like sales.
Sure.
You have to fill your funnel.
Yeah.
The more activity breeds results. So the more people you get out there and speak with, the faster you probably are going to engage with donors, get them interested in who you are and what you do. And at the end of the day, you're going to see the results that you need to achieve your targets. If you look at how long it takes to run an event in a year to get that all planned, to finally see and have the realization of what that money meant versus how many donors could you see and speak to every single week over a year. I think when you look at that analogy, who's going to make the most money or most dollars for the charity? So that's why I looked at it that way. I looked at that outside lane as very much arm's length, mm-hmm. doing our fundraising, not really speaking to our donors because we're just too busy organizing the event. And the actual reality is, you don't even really speak to your donors until the event actually happens.
Right.
You speak to your sponsors, but you don't actually speak to a lot of the people that come to participate. And so versus when that inner lane, hands-on lane, that's the way I looked at it. That's why you're speaking to them every week. You're not waiting a year to speak to them at an event. You're actually speaking to them every day.
Hey, go back to that point you just made, because I don't think I've ever had anybody point that out. I think everybody gets that. But yeah, so let's say you plan an event for 9 months. You plan an mm-hmm. event for 9 months, and then mm-hmm. and the event's a 2-hour dinner or something, right? It's not, mm-hmm. what do you have, a span of a couple of hours? And so you convince yourself, what's going on in our head that convinces us that we're actually having meaningful conversations with these people when we only interact with them for 2 hours? It must mm-hmm. be the idea. It must be the idea that for 9 months leading up to that, we're thinking, mm-hmm. Let's say we're thinking about them, right? So they're occupying mental energy in our head. But we're not actually interacting with them at all.
No. One of the events I run is a charity motorcycle ride.
Yeah.
It's going into its 16th year.
Mm-hmm.
Very successful. It's organized where the police escort us, and it's a non-touchdown ride, and which means the riders love it because once they get on their bike, they go for an hour.
Yeah.
And it takes us about 9 months to organize that. And it's always successful. They like to come out probably because they like the motorcycle ride. Some people like to come out because they understand who Lansdowne is. And we look after children with special needs. So an aunt, an uncle, a dad, whatever, is riding in that ride to support Lansdowne because we have provided such phenomenal services to their child with special needs. But I spent 9 months organizing that event. And on the day of the event, as somebody that organizes the event, did I have enough time to go to every single rider, which was 260 riders, and have that conversation with every single one of them about, thank you for coming. We right. appreciate your support of Lansdowne. You know, we look after children with special needs, occupational therapy, physiotherapy. Is that a reality? Absolutely no way.
Right.
So, and I spent 9 months organizing this. So I try via social media to capture them, they all get a pledge sheet, which talks about our services. Not everybody actually uses the pledge sheet. Versus me going out for dinner with a philanthropist or a CEO in town and having the opportunity to really sit down in a quiet area and talk about, passionately talk about who we are and what we do. So I see that as being the difference.
Yeah, so
the events are absolutely necessary, and we run three very successful events. But what we were weak in is taking the time to just do some one-on-one.
Mm-hmm. Which one's actually going to keep you? Yeah, you know, one of the things I don't think that enough of us who are talking about the fact that fundraising professionals turn over too often, and there's a lot of criticism mm-hmm. There's a lot of theories. I guess there's a lot of theories about why fundraisers come and go so quickly.
Well, I can tell you why. I can tell you why they turn over.
I mean, which of those two options to sort of to do your work in a particular way? Just speaking for myself, it's that opportunity to sit down and have that meaningful conversation and ask for that very significant gift that's going to keep me in the job. And having talked to you now just a couple of times, I have to imagine that that's actually what's keeping you in your job, is the opportunity to actually sit down and do something extraordinary.
I'm in silent capital campaign. I want to shovel in the ground, Wendell. I'll tell you, in my opinion, all right. So I personally think that it depends on what charity you're working for, but if you're working for a charity in which you're a small organization, it's to support and sustain another it's to support and sustain your organization. The reality is that who you are and what you do as a professional may sometimes not be understood. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm saying? So that's one of the reasons I love going to Congress, because I sit in a room full of other fundraisers who get me, who understand me, who know my life and know what I do every day. But it's no fault. I work in an organization of 240 staff that work within the center part, but I'm on the fundraising arm of it. I'm part of the foundation, which is totally separate. And so I've spent the last 3 years doing presentations to the staff to explain, well, what is a fundraiser and what does a fundraiser do? And it's really having to build our, I'm building the brand of the center, but building the brand of the fundraiser. What is AFP? What's a CFRE? What is a professional fundraiser? Why is it good to have a professional fundraiser? And I consider this a profession. Why is it good to have someone like that attached to your charity? And it's not just about making money. It's about building your brand. It's about talking about who are you and what do you do and why are you necessary and why are you an important person in the community. So it's more than just raising money. And I think, unfortunately, even when I speak with my friends, I think most of them think all I do is run events. And when I say, oh, no, there's plan giving and annual giving and monthly giving. And sometimes I think we as fundraisers, it's just tough because this is, it's very, very competitive. If you're in a small, Toronto versus my small town, sometimes I feel like it's night and day difference. And it's very competitive. It's a very tough profession. And the people that do well in it, they're in it for the right reasons. They're passionate, they're philanthropic, they have a big heart, and they want to make a difference. If you don't have that desire, then I think you need to really rethink what you're doing. And some people say to me, how is it that I have no issues asking for money? And it's, well, I'm not asking for me. Mm-hmm. I'm asking it for my charity. Mm-hmm. Because I know we need it, and I know what a difference it's going to make to my kids with special needs. So I think when I see how many people have come and gone, it's because they weren't understood or supported. I encourage my other fundraisers in the city, join AFP, go to Congress, take seminars, go with your tribe. You know, go and be join your tribe and talk about, as a group of fundraisers, like we did in your seminar that I went to. It was a group of formidable, influential fundraisers in that room. And it was nice to be in that room where we all spoke about, oh, yeah, I've been stuck on that outside lane. And my boss didn't understand that you couldn't make $100,000 that quickly. I'm trying to be in that inside lane. And there's only so many donors in my community, and we're all calling them up. But, you know, it was nice to talk to other people that walk your walk.
Yeah, but there's some, if you listen to yourself, I get the benefit of sitting on the other side of this conversation. I'm listening to you, Angie, and a lot of what you're saying is that you want to be known. And it's not an arrogance, I want to be known. It's just you want to be known, you know? It's just like all of us, we're all human beings.
I want to be known. I would like that when I see somebody as a CA or an MD, I understand what they do for a living.
Yeah, right.
But when I say to somebody, well, I'm a fundraiser and I joined the AFP and I work really hard and I go to Congress, I'm trying to get my CFRE, an absolute blank stare comes across their face. So unless you are in our profession, you don't understand that.
Yeah.
You really don't. And then when you sit and you talk to people and you say, this is who I belong to. As a fundraiser, sometimes get a bit of a bad name, but I say, oh, are you kidding? I personally have our donor rights, our 10 donor rights. It is glued to the front of my door.
Yeah.
I'm totally transparent. I'm ethical. I follow standards just like other people do. I don't worry about me being known because it's not about me. But if you understand that you understand our profession, I think it definitely helps us.
Yeah, but you don't. Okay, so think about this from a go back to that 9-month event planning process. Human beings do not like to spend 9 months you're almost describing it in isolation. So you've got nine months of planning this event to therefore be mm-hmm. known in a figurative mm-hmm. sense, to sort of use that mm-hmm. phrase. Mm-hmm. Only to be known for like 2 or 3 hours, only to turn around and start that process again.
I warned my young lady that we just hired. She just did our first time event, and she poured her heart and soul into this event, and she did an amazing job. And I warned her. I warned her. I said, I'm going to tell you that when the event's over, the next couple of days, you kind of come down,
yeah,
a little down.
Exactly. Right.
And I said, she's not married. And I said, but I remember planning my wedding, you know, the flowers, the cake, the music. And then when it was over, it was like that song. Is that all it is? You know, it was, cause it's like, oh, it's over. And I looked at her and I said, okay, now go do all your stewardship. Make sure everybody is thanked. Love everybody. Give them a t-shirt. You know, we do picture. We come up with these beautiful montages of pictures for the events so that our sponsors that didn't know what it was about and didn't come, they get a real good feeling for it. So we then hit the road, and that's where we've gone from that outside lane.
Right.
Into the inside lane. And that's what I enjoy the most, is going out to them and saying, you made a difference. You did this. You've helped us achieve this.
Yeah. Nobody operating, whether it's the donor or the fundraiser or really anybody in that shallow space out on that outer lane, becomes known. But we pretend like we do. For a couple of hours every year, we gather together and we pretend like we're all best friends. And then you have to come off that high and do it all over again.
Yeah. And you know, it's like the news, like who was on the front page last week?
Right.
I can't even tell you who was on the front page last week, like, because our world now, I mean, our world now moves so quickly. We are some bombarded with information, whether it's websites, newspaper, online Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn. It's hard for our brains to keep all those messages straight. And it's like, you know, and so in terms of a charity, and it's not just my charity, I'm going to tell you, hospitals and hospices are obvious. We all know what they do. But there's so many charities that I've met at Congress that I sort of know the name, but I have not too sure about what they do. Because we're all doing good work. We're all doing necessary good work. But who you are and what you do and why you do it and how you do it and who you're doing it for, the who, what, where, when, why scenario sometimes is the thing that's not answered. So that's why the arm's length running around that long, big part of the track, which is what I explained to the board, when you're thinking about a capital campaign, that's when it's critical that you know who your top people are within your community so that you can have those close conversations with you're not going to have a chance to do it at a walk or at a motorcycle ride.
Angie, I've had you for about a half hour now. So if somebody's listening to us and they're saying, I'd like to reach out to Angie, how would you suggest that they do that?
I'm on LinkedIn. On LinkedIn, my name is Angie Bevan Turnbull. I have my maiden name there because when I left Toronto, I'm originally from Toronto, I thought people are going to have even my high school friends, maybe I'd still like to connect with them. So connecting with me on LinkedIn, because you can private message me on LinkedIn. And then that's probably the best way. And then I encourage anyone to, if they're wondering who we are and what we do, we are Lansdowne, Lansdowne, Children's Center in Brantford. I mean, we're a children's treatment center. We're one of 21 in Ontario that look after children with special needs. So you can follow our Facebook and Instagram, and it gives you a really good idea of who we are and what we're doing. Okay, I have to plug me, so yeah. But it's been a pleasure, and I have to just say thank you, because your seminar, I didn't know everything about fundraising, and I still don't, and it really gave me ammunition to go towards my board and say, listen, we can be better at doing this, but we need to divide and conquer, which is what we've done here in our office now.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.